Like I was saying before, Gary and Judy's out of town this weekend. They're celebrating their 40th anniversary, and for some unknown reason, he asked me to teach the Torah portion tonight. I'm still trying to figure that one out. I can usually teach any subject somebody throws at me, you know, lots of different things, but for some reason, when someone asks you to teach the Torah portion, it takes on a whole new level of nervousness. And if you've ever taught, you know what I'm talking about, don't you? See, Jolene's back there nodding her head real good. See, I tried to con her earlier this afternoon of doing this for me, and she wouldn't do it. So we're going ahead and get started. And, of course, the Torah portion he leaves me with is not one of the easy ones. You know, it's one of the big, deep, deep, deep ones, you know. Of course, he can't leave me with an easy one. He's got to leave me with one of the biggest ones in the Torah. But, first of all, who's glad the holiday's over? There you go. That's what I thought. If I hear Merry Christmas one more time, I'm going to shoot myself. Or if I hear that argument, Merry Christmas versus Happy Holidays. Holy moly. Who's heard that one? This oh my gosh. Is it not crazy? Or a holiday tree versus a Christmas tree. They're both pagan. Throw them out. That's the way I look at it. So we're going ahead and get started on the Torah portion. It starts in Genesis chapter 44, verse 18. I've got a couple of articles here that I'm going to be teaching from, plus the Torah portion here. This thing is so hard and so deep this week that I hope I can at least scratch the surface with it. And I hope I don't bore you to tears or confuse too many of you. We've went through the first 10 weeks. Can you believe that? We're done with Genesis already, almost. One more week and we're done with the book of Genesis. It seemed like yesterday we were at Sukkot, don't it? We were finishing up, we were setting up the tent, and Genesis is over with. Almost over with. We're going to get ready to start into Exodus next week, or week after next, excuse me. Just look back at what all we've looked at in the last 10 weeks. We've went through the heavens and earth have been created and then supposedly destroyed through the flood. All the foundation for God and man's relations have been established with covenants. We've learned from Abraham how to hear God's voice, how we're to listen to his promises, how to instruct our children, how to set up our households following his ways, doing righteousness and judgment. The family's been created, and now we're ready for some action when we get through this Torah portion. We've learned from Isaac on how to plead with God for on the behalf of our families. We've learned from Isaac how to take up the torch passed on from our forefathers, but yet take that torch and not just copy what they've done, to make it our own, to, you know, put our spin, as you know, some might say, on the Torah. And we've learned from Jacob how to wrestle with God and wrestle with man and hold on until he blesses us. And how to make repentance, we've learned from Jacob. Jacob had to do a lot of repentance in his life. And most recently, we've looked at Joseph and Judah, how they interact with pagan society and culture. Boy, we should know something about that, shouldn't we? We're right there with that. We learn what works and what doesn't work in that regard, too. Okay, up until the last couple of weeks, the Torah portions have really had a common theme. And that theme has been that God himself has been vocally in these Torah portions. He said something that someone's heard in almost every single one of them. But in the last two, including this one, he's been silent. You know, it's been great up till now. You know, we've got used to this whole idea that every time a problem we have come up, we're going to hear God's voice, and he's going to tell us what we need to do. He's going to tell us where we went wrong, and everything will be all right. Well, now we get to Joseph's story, and uh-oh, he's quiet. We got to figure some things out on our own. Just kind of scary, isn't it? It's kind of scary to go through life when you can't hear the voice of God. Hopefully, over the last 2 weeks of reading these Torah portions, we've realized something, that we don't know God nearly as good as we think we do. We've also come to the recognition that God doesn't just sit there. He's not going to, nor will he inject himself into our daily lives. He's going to let us drive our lives for a little bit and see what kind of mess we can make out of it. I'm going to make a statement here, and I think we all could really learn something, because when I read it, it really struck home to me. The world revolves around him and his plan, not us and our perception of needs. I think that's something we all really need to learn from. Because especially in the Messianic movement that we're in, the Hebrew roots, Torah observant, whatever term you want to use it, there is a danger of arrogance to slip in. And it's understandable why we could get arrogant. because God has chose us as a remnant to come out of the church, and He has revealed things to us that most people have never heard of. Most people in this room, and I include most of the kids, have enough Bible knowledge with them right now that they could take down just about any preacher in this county. And that's kind of scary. So when we start looking at ourselves saying, hey, I know a whole lot, you know, arrogance can kind of creep in. So we got to be really careful. Sometimes we found out that it serves His purpose for Him to hide from our view and be silent, even in the face of horrible suffering. That's a big one, I thought, because things are starting to come into play now in the world to where there's going to be some suffering happen. The tribulation is on its way. Whether it's next year, 2 years, 5 years away, it's not far off. There is some suffering coming. There's going to be a lot of growing pains for us. And the question is, can you handle it? Can you handle a world like that where you can't hear the voice of God? Where God doesn't speak audibly to you like He did Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Can you worship Him and love Him with all your heart, soul, and mind when you can't hear Him? All you've got is some words on a piece of paper to read. So let's get started. First of all, in this Torah study, or any Torah study, not just this one, any Torah study is not designed for an amateur-type study. If you're going to study Torah, you better be prepared for some deep, deep study. From the beginning, from the Genesis 1:1 up to the point we're at now, all the way through the Torah portion, the Torah is like a two-edged sword. It reveals a lot of good things to us, some wonderful, wonderful truths. But at the same time, it reveals some really bad stuff about us too, doesn't it? It cuts both ways. It helps us. It challenges our worldview. It confronts our complacency. It reveals our hypocrisy, our arrogance, the sin in our life. It's not always fun and games, is it? Sometimes it's painful to read the Torah portions. It's kind of embarrassing because you read them and you see what these other people have went through and you're like, hey, I'm doing the exact same thing they're doing. I need to watch what I'm doing. Another thing that doing a Torah study is most of the time, and I know this is true with me, is that it leaves you with more questions than answers. Anybody else ever experienced that? When you get through reading the Torah portion, you got more questions at the end than you did at the beginning, and you're just, you know, confused. I think that God intentionally done that so that we, no matter how much we study or pray, we can't come close to comprehending in all of it. That way we have to depend on Him, that we don't get proud and arrogant and try to do everything in our own power. Because when we do that, we really mess up. When we start doing things in our own power, things are just terrible. Okay, so let's start in about the... I'm sorry. Let's start in Genesis 46 right quick. I kind of lost my place there. Sorry about that. We're going to start in verse 3 and 4 just to get started out in 46. Well, let's just start in verse 1. So Israel set out with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob, and he said, here I am. He said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt. I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will close your eyes. The final message of God in the book of Genesis is pretty simple. It's the stage is now set. All the conditions are met, and it's time for Israel to go into exile. He's took us from the very beginning of when he created man, got us all the way here to his chosen family. He's got the family he's going to bring salvation to the world in, and now it's time to go into Egypt. Now, this is something God told Abraham a long, long time ago. Though the embrace of one pharaoh would turn the enslavement into another, it's actually going to turn out to be all right. There's going to be a lot of bloodshed and suffering and misery on the children of Israel over the next few hundred years while they're in Egypt, but things are going to turn out all right. There's going to be a lot of them drowned in the Nile, but guess what? God's going to bring them out by his mighty arm and his strong right hand. It doesn't seem possible to us that considering all the pain and personal tragedy that it's going to turn out all right. Whether it seems to us or not, it will be all right. You know, when I read that, something that struck me was this is a pattern. It's a pattern for the end times that we're in. And tribulation is going to be tough. We sometimes forget that, the tribulation, you know, we kind of get, oh, that's going to be easy. It's going to be easy to get through the tribulation. Well, when you start reading the pattern, no, it's not going to be so easy. It's going to be kind of tough on us. And there's going to be a lot of people, a lot of Torah observant people that die during the tribulation. That's something we forget. You know, we think, okay, we keep the law, we keep Torah, we're God's bondservants, He's going to protect us. Well, yes, He will, but there's some of us that are going to be martyred. I mean, we're no better than the apostles, are we? Paul was a martyr, wasn't he? Why shouldn't one of us be a martyr? So, you know, that's that arrogance thing that tends to creep into us again. We got to remember, sometimes bad things happen even to us. Okay. As we recall, last week during our portion, it ended with Jacob's sons, including Benjamin. Don't forget Benjamin. They were in Egypt in some serious trouble. Remember last week? I know we didn't have services last week because of the weather, but hopefully you read the portion. And the way it ended was the sons of Israel were standing before Joseph, who they didn't know was Joseph. They just thought he was the prime minister. And they're in a mess because he had sent them away with food, and all of a sudden, Joseph's silver cup was in Benjamin's bag. So all of them get hauled back to the palace in front of Joseph. And Joseph has got this trap designed to get Benjamin away from his elder half-brothers. Like I said, he had his servants plant that silver cup from his palace, and he's arranged for it to be found. Joseph also has arranged for Benjamin to be arrested, brought before him, and to serve life as a slave to Joseph. Of course, Joseph didn't have any intention of doing this. He wasn't going to make his brother Benjamin some terrible slave and just be horrible to him. What I think Joseph's mindset was that as soon as his half-brothers were out of sight, once they went away and gave up, that Joseph would reveal himself to Benjamin, and he would show Benjamin who he was and become a mentor to him that he never had the chance to be, because not only did Joseph get ripped away from his father, he, you know, never got to know his little brother. You know, Joseph probably expected his half-brothers to be more than happy to get rid of Benjamin. I never really thought about that till I studied this week. And, you know, they were more than happy to get rid of Joseph 22 years ago before this time, weren't they? Well, you know, it's reasonable for them for Joseph to assume that, hey, they want to get rid of Benjamin too. You know, Benjamin's the son of Rachel, and Jacob loved Rachel more than he did Leah or the other wives, so of course they're going to want to get rid of him. Actually, I think Joseph was testing his brothers to see if they had changed any over the last 22 years. Joseph was gambling, actually, is what he was doing. He was, you know, almost like playing roulette with it. And he thought he was going to win this big bet. You know, he said, I'll play these boys, they'll leave, and I'll get Benjamin back. Well, what poor old Joseph didn't realize was the house was about to lose the bet. The situation changed all of a sudden, and who did it change because of? Well, of course, God's the one that orchestrated this whole thing, but as usual, God used an earthly vessel to bring about this change. Who did he use? He used Judah. So at the end of last week's Torah portion, Joseph announced that Benjamin would be a slave and the other brothers would be free. But what did Judah do? He stood up and said some stuff, didn't he? Let's turn back to Genesis 44, verse 16. I know that's a couple of verses before our Torah portion, but this Torah portion ends with like a cliffhanger. So you got to kind of go back a little bit. So Judah said, "What can we say to my Lord? What can we speak? And how can we justify ourselves? God has found the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's slaves, both we and the ones whose possession the cup has been found." This is from the very one who 22 years ago come up with this plan to get rid of Joseph. Now, isn't this interesting? What a change of events we've got. We've got 22 years ago, you've got Judah, who was more than happy to take his own little brother, like 17 years old, throw him in a pit, and sell him for 20 pieces of silver, I think it was. You know, next to nothing. He wouldn't have anything to do with Joseph 22 years ago, but now he's standing up for the other son. What I took from this was that sometimes it takes some really tough tribulation for people to change. You know, most of us in here haven't seen really a whole lot of tribulation in our lives. We've been pretty lucky. We've not had to go through a whole lot in order to see the truths of the Torah. But there's a lot of people out there, and you know the ones I'm talking about. You've talked to them many, many times, that you can show them this stuff over and over and over and over, but yet they won't listen, will they? It's going to take some trouble, some guilt, and some really bad times for a lot of these people to listen. Let's take just a minute here and think about what Judah is saying here. Judah is refusing to return to Canaan. Not only is he refusing, he's saying all the brothers are going to stay. So now what does that mean for him? Now obviously it means he's going to stay in Egypt as Joseph's slave, but what does it mean for the people back home? Because remember, there's a famine raging throughout the entire Middle East right now. It's not just located in Egypt, it's all over the entire world actually. There's people starving. The only reason they came to Egypt was for what? They came to Egypt to get food. That's the only reason they came. If there hadn't been a famine, they would have stayed in Canaan with their father and their wives. For them to stay in Egypt meant that Jacob, Leah, Bilhah, Zilpah, and all their wives and their children too would have been without protection. They'd been unprotected. They would have had no food and virtually condemned to die of starvation or even worse without some kind of miracle. Even if Judah was buying time and hoping for some kind of opportunity to rescue Benjamin and then get back to Canaan as quickly as he could before it was too late, this would have been a fool's bet. This kind of bet was hopeless. It wouldn't have worked because Joseph had all the resources that Judah didn't. Judah didn't know who Joseph was. He didn't know that his refusal to leave Benjamin and thereby sentencing Jacob and all the rest of the family to certain death was one bet that poor old Joseph couldn't cover. Joseph didn't see that coming. He didn't expect Judah to do that. So while Joseph kept his poker face and appeared to be in total charge, he's actually shaking in his boots because he didn't know what his next move was going to be. Judah steps forward now and he gives one of the most wonderful speeches, and he takes this whole situation to the next level too. Let's pick up in verse 18 where the Torah portion starts today, and we're going to read through verse 34. Starting in verse 18 in Genesis 44, "Then Judah approached him and said, 'O my Lord, may your servant please speak a word in my Lord's ears, and do not be angry with your servant, for you are equal to Pharaoh.' My Lord asked his servant, saying, 'Have you a father or brother?' We said to my Lord, 'We have a father and a little child of his old age. Now his brother is dead, so he alone is left of his mother, and his father loves him.' Then you said to your servants, 'Bring him down to me that I may set my eyes on him.' But we said to my Lord, 'The lad cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die.' You said to your servants, however, 'Unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you will not see my face again.' Thus it came about when we went to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my Lord. Our father said, 'Go back, buy us a little food.' But we said, 'We cannot go down. If our youngest brother is not with us, then we will not go down, for we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Your servant, my father, said to us, 'You know that my wife bore me two sons, and the one went out from me, and I said, "Surely he is torn in pieces, and I have not seen him since. If you take this one from me also, and harm befalls him, you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow. Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, when he sees that the lad is not with us, he will die. Thus your servants will bring the gray hair of your servant, our father, down to Sheol in sorrow. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, "If I do not bring him back to you, then let me bear the blame before my father forever. Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad, a slave to my lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, for fear that I see the evil that would overtake my father?" Okay, in this week's Torah portion, that was kind of an introduction. In this Torah portion, I don't think we'll get to all of these. There's about 14 things that I saw that we need to kind of remember. We've got Judah's proposal of a substitutionary atonement. That sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? A substitutionary atonement kind of reminds me of a Ramez level of the Messiah coming and being our atonement. Then we have a son of the covenant awakens. Joseph, he's going to reveal himself to his brothers in this Torah portion, but there's something else that happens. Joseph remembers actually who he really is, because Joseph had been in Egypt for a long time and kind of had forgotten who he was. But when he meets up with his brothers, all of this stuff comes rushing back to him. That's a really good part of this Torah portion. Joseph gives some instructions to his brothers. Joseph was the father of Ephraim, and you know, we are the descendants of Ephraim, so you can tie Ephraim and Joseph together here. And Ephraim has some insights that Judah doesn't. And when we're restored, we're going to be able to give some insights to Judah, and of course, they're going to give us some insights as well. But there's some really good instructions that Joseph gives to his brothers in this portion. There's the emotional reunion of Joseph with his brothers. When Ephraim and Judah finally do get reunited and the restoration does take place, it is going to be a major emotional day. We're all going to be very, very happy that we are reunited with our brothers. There's also Pharaoh's first decree concerning the covenant family. Pharaoh hears that Joseph's brothers are in his country, and he issues this great, wonderful invitation, doesn't he? Well, Pharaoh's got some hidden motives behind this invitation, so you kind of got to watch him. Joseph sends his brothers back to Cana, bearing some gifts. The brothers reveal some amazing news to Joseph. All of a sudden, Israel hears that the good news of Joseph. Joseph is a type and shadow of who? Yeshua. He finds out he's alive, and that's kind of a Ramez level of all of Israel learning who the Messiah really is. Jacob, in the eighth point we've got here, Jacob has his final encounter with God before his death. This is the last time God's going to speak to Jacob before he dies. Then we have the listing of all who go down to Egypt, and there's really good prophecy in that portion. I doubt we'll get to it tonight because this is a very long portion. But I challenge you to get into that when it talks about the 70 people that went down. If you've never done a study about the 70 people who went down, I highly recommend it. What you need to do when you do it, it's in Genesis 46. You need to count the people that went down. Make your list of the mothers and the sons and the grandsons and even the great-grandchildren. Don't forget the daughters, and do some counting and see what you come up with. You're going to find out something that's going to blow your mind, because I can show you a mistake in the Bible right there. And of course, I use that word mistake with quotes around it. It's not really a mistake. There's a hidden prophecy there if you'll take the time to look at it. We've got Judah is chosen to act as a forerunner of the rest of the brothers, which is another great prophecy, another pattern. Then we've got Joseph's tearful reunion with Jacob. Then we've got Jacob and his family meeting Pharaoh. Then we've got the details of the effects of the famine. And then we've got the covenant family multiplies and prospers in its new home. Okay, going on into this Torah portion, we're going to see a few things. We're going to see that Joseph finally reveals his true identity to his brothers. Now remember, we were talking a minute ago how Joseph is the grandfather of Ephraim, so we can tie those two men together and use that as a reference to look at us in the modern day era. And we're going to see that Joseph reveals his true identity to his brothers. He's ushering in the first phase of the reconciliation. The second thing we're going to see in this portion is that a temporary place of sojourn outside the promised land with all its necessary provisions are going to be provided to the family. Like I talked about a minute ago, Jacob's going to have his final encounter with God before he passes away. And then, fourthly, a very interesting one we're going to try to get into is we're going to see the prophecy of an economic policy of the beast of the book of Revelation. The economic policy at the end of this Torah portion, a lot of times we just kind of skim over because it doesn't mean anything to us. But when you dig deeper and you look at today's patterns of our economic situation we're in versus the economic situation that we read about, it's almost like reading the newspaper. So that was very interesting. Remember, all this is taking place. Pharaoh's in control. Pharaoh's the power. He is the government, which is something you need to remember. So anytime we read about Pharaoh in this portion, kind of get in your mind's eye that we're talking about a world government. Okay, moving on. Let's talk about Judah's personal plea here. Joseph, of course, when Judah stepped up to him and said, "Let me say something to you," of course Joseph said, extended his scepter and allowed Judah to approach him, because Joseph knew that Judah was the chief of the brothers now. This is something actually that Joseph had secretly desired his entire life. You know, Joseph had all these brothers, but they always mistreated him as a kid, didn't they? They didn't like him. He was this dreamer, this upstart kid that daddy liked better than the rest of them. So they didn't much care for him. He's never experienced anything like this with his brothers, and he's always wanted to. Judah starts to bargain for Benjamin's soul, kind of like the way Abraham did for Lot and his family. Most of Judah's communication is a presentation of his perspective on the events in the Torah portion in Miketz, if you remember 2 weeks ago. Judah's description of Jacob's response to the news that Simeon was imprisoned in Egypt, and the only way to free him was to risk Benjamin's life. So now, you know, poor old Jacob's lost one son 22 years ago. Now he's got one in prison, and in order to get the one out of prison, he's got to risk another son's life. So poor old Jacob's really in for it. Let's jump to Genesis 44:27 right quick. And read again what was said here. And 27, "Your servant my father said to us, 'You know that my wife bore me two sons, and one went out from me, and I said, surely he is torn in pieces, and I have not seen him since. If you take this one from me also, and harm befalls him, you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow.'" Jacob's basically saying, if this happens, you're going to kill me. That if I lose more children this way, I'm going to die. Now remember, it was Judah's idea to put poor old Joseph back in that pit 22 years ago. So all this actually is whose fault? It's Judah's fault. He's the one that had this idea. He's the reason his father is suffering so much. Judah, I think, at this point, is feeling some major league guilt. Judah had brought the coat of many colors back to Jacob with blood on it, and what did he do? He walked in front of his father and he said, "Do you recognize this?" Now, how much pain do you think that put poor old Jacob through? Because of course, they knew what it was. They could have found an easier way to break it to their father, but they didn't. They found a very, very cruel way. Which brings me to the point of this whole part we've just been talking about. It's the power to hurt others. Every one of us, every single one of us in this room on this entire planet have the ability to cause some serious pain to other people, don't we? Have you, like Judah, caused years of anguish to another person? Have you, by your words or actions, or by an uncaring silence or inaction, by something you did or even something you didn't do, caused someone great misery on a parent, on a spouse, a sibling, a child, or a friend? Be honest with yourself. You know, you don't have to say it in front of all of us, but be honest with yourself. Have you done something like that? I'll have to admit it, I have. All of us have. If you've done this, it doesn't mean you're the scum of the earth and you should be cast out and never spoken to again. What you need to do is make restitution. You need to make repentance. You need to apologize to this person, draw near to God, acknowledge your errors, and petition Him to release the healing power into the lives of those you've hurt. Not only that, something that a lot of times we forget, not only do we need to apologize and ask forgiveness from someone else, it's great when they forgive us. We need to forgive ourselves for our mistakes sometimes. I don't know about the rest of you, but there's no one harder on me than I am. When I make a mistake, nobody else is harder on me than me. And I need to forgive myself for things I've done in the past. And a lot of times we do too, because we hold ourselves back because we continue to punish ourselves over and over and over. How many of you have committed sins or done things before? You've asked forgiveness. God Himself has forgiven you. It feels great, doesn't it? But you keep beating yourself up over it. Who are you to keep punishing yourself for something God has forgiven? You ever thought of it that way? Would you ever punish someone else for something that God had forgiven them for? Of course not. You would forgive them. You need to do the same for yourself. Forgive others and forgive yourself and move on. Learn from your mistakes. You'll learn more from your mistakes than you will your successes in life. Let's jump over to verse 32 in this chapter of Genesis 44. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then let me bear the blame before my father forever. Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad, a slave to my lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, for fear that I see the evil that would overtake my father? Basically, with these words, when he said this, Judah was quiet. It was pretty much over. That's all he could do. He's made his case to Joseph, and he's hoping and praying to God that things work out. But he is at he's at his wit's end. He has nothing else. He's laid his cards on the table, and he's hoping that things work out his way. Now, if you remember the last time that Joseph and Judah were this close together, things were a lot different, weren't they? Poor old Joseph was a 17-year-old skinny little kid that had been thrown into a pit and was being sold. He was attacked. He was beaten. He was stripped of his garment, thrown into a pit. He cried out to his brothers, but what did they do? They did nothing for him. They heard them laughing. But then they also, Joseph actually overheard the plan to sell him. Could you imagine your siblings talking about selling you to a group of people? Wouldn't that be an awful thing to hear? The last thing you heard from your brother was, I'm going to sell you to this band of slave owners here. And then he's going to tell his father. He knew that they were going to tell his father that he'd been killed. So he knew the pain and anguish that poor old Jacob was going to feel. But circumstances have changed now, hasn't it? Judah's the one that's in trouble. Judah's the one sitting here at the mercy of Joseph. Joseph has the power and the ability to crush Judah right now. He could force him into a lifetime of slavery, or Joseph could just summarily have him executed. You know that? That's how powerful Joseph was. There was only one other person more powerful than Joseph in the whole land, and that was Pharaoh. And Pharaoh doesn't care about one person, does he? He wouldn't care if Joseph had Judah killed. What would you do in a situation like this? Kind of hard question to answer, isn't it? But guess what? This is a Ramez level, a hidden level, a prophecy of something that's going to happen. This is going to happen again. A lot of us in this room and online have been persecuted, have been abused. Our families won't have anything to do with us. We've lost friends. We've been kicked out of churches. All because of what we believe, right? Well, when tribulation happens, what's going to happen? Churches are going to start falling. They're going to start crumbling. And where are they going to go? They're going to come to you. The tables are going to be turned. You're going to be Joseph. They're going to be Judah coming to you. What are you going to do? You have the ability. You have the knowledge to help them get through the tribulation. What are you going to do? Is that not scary? Because if you think about it from a fleshly point of view, what are you going to do? Hit the road, Jack. You're on your own. Remember what you did to me? Be honest. Every one of us would do it. You'd want to do it. It's in there. I don't care how nice you think you are. It's in there. We know it. So it's something that you really, really, really need to think about, because this is going to happen again. Okay, let's jump over to chapter 45 as we get started trying to get through this. As we start reading in chapter 45, we're discovering that the famine, which God has warned Pharaoh about in this dream, is throughout the entire world. What's worse, the famine is in its second year, and there's a seven-year famine. So we got five more years. Luckily, things in Egypt are pretty well in hand despite the famine, thanks to the aggressive food storage program instituted by Joseph. But in Canaan, things are a lot more bleak. So moving on, the good God in his greatness has, and his truity to his covenant with Abraham, has arranged for an abundant provision to be stored up for Egypt. In other words, he's got a way out. He's got a way for Jacob and his family to survive. There's another hidden prophecy for us, tribulation. He's got a hidden way for us to survive. Something else that's getting ready to happen in this Torah portion is the days of separation are getting ready to draw to a close. Restoration is getting ready to happen, and it gets really exciting. The separation I'm talking about is the broken line of communication between Joseph and his father Israel. Now remember, we talked about Joseph being the father of Ephraim, so we can use Ephraim here as well. So Ephraim and Israel, Ephraim and Judah, the days of their separation are coming to an end. Jacob's been deceived into believing that Joseph is dead. He's been torn apart by wild beasts in the 17th year of his life. There's this conspiracy that the brothers have, that they've been keeping going for 22 years about this. And as a result of this, the divine communication has completely dried up for the house of Israel. There's nothing really relevant or fantastic taking place in the 22 years that Joseph's been gone with Jacob and his family. They've basically just been surviving. This is getting ready to come to an end because God's going to do some wonderful, wonderful things. This kind of reminded me of Judah, modern-day Judah, or the Jews. Joseph's a type and shadow of Yeshua, and they really think he's dead and gone and no more, right? So ever since then, they've kind of been placed over here to the side, haven't they? Nothing really fantastic has happened. I mean, some things have, but God's really not used them on a global aspect like he's going to in the future. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying the Jews have been done away with by no stretch of the imagination. I'm not teaching like a lot of the church does that the Jews are gone and they are no more. He's not discarded the Jews. He's not abandoned them. But consequences of their actions, just like for us, and don't think just because we're not quote-unquote Jews that we're getting out of this because we're right there with them, the consequences of their actions have put them in this situation. And it's the same way with the church. The consequences of our actions has put us where we're at today. Basically, both groups, the church and the Jews, are surviving naturally according to the ways and wisdom of man, but they're spiritually blind. Now, is that not a mouthful right there? They're surviving on their own, on the ways of man and the wisdom of man. And if this Torah portion wasn't perfect for this past week, tell me what was. The ways of man. How many arguments of Christmas have you heard? I heard one today about, well, we know it's got its roots in paganism, but we use it to celebrate our family. You know, it's the ways of man, not the ways of God people are interested in. Despite this, the deception and despair on the part of Jacob's family, combined with the unatoned blood guilt of his 10 eldest sons, has prevented the family from being close to God like they need to be. Can you imagine poor old Jacob on every birthday that Joseph had, what he felt like for the last 22 years? Or the day that he quote-unquote died? Can you imagine poor old Jacob, what he went through? Or when Rachel's, birthday come around, he'd think about Rachel, and then Joseph's dead too. You know, I feel really sorry for poor old Jacob. I mean, I know a lot of his actions brought this on himself, but Jacob had a tough life. The famine for bread that we're talking about in this Torah portion is affecting the world physically, but it's also affecting it on a spiritual level, isn't it? The blind are leading the blind. Now, that's another mouthful right there. When it comes to a spiritual truth, the blind are leading the blind. We've got false doctrines that are repeated over and over and changed and twisted and turned. And I could sit here and talk about them all night if we wanted to. Christmas being one of the big ones that's on everybody's mind. But pre-tribulation rapture is another one that comes up. This is what happens when you depend on the ways of man. Unbeknownst to Jacob or any of his family, God is about to repair the separation. As a result, a dramatic shift is going to occur, and God will move his chosen family to a very special place that he's prepared for them. At that place, God will preserve his covenant for all his people. He's going to nurture them back to health, and he will, through great trials and tribulations, prepare them to become his kingdom of priests and a holy nation that's going to change this planet forever. So let's get on to the reparation and the redemption process. How's he going to go about doing this? Here's how he's going to do it. He's going to raise up another nation and bless them so richly that he's going to provoke the household of Jacob to jealousy. So to bring this to pass, God is going to shake everything that can be shaken. Let me be a little more specific here for you. At this time, 12 of Jacob's sons are in Egypt temporarily. What they're doing is they're trying to get Simeon out of prison and buy grain. But none of them, including Jacob, have any intention of moving to Egypt. They have no idea that Goshen exists, much less where it is or what it's like. They might be jealous of Egypt's prosperity, but they want nothing to do with Egypt itself. They want nothing, you know, that saying that makes me think of modern-day Jews have no interest in reuniting with Ephraim right now, do they? And when I say that, I mean the leadership, the Orthodox, the people in power really don't have any interest in reuniting with Ephraim. How is God going to get everyone's attention? He's going to convince them to move to Egypt, the last place in the world they want to be. That's what God's going to do to both the Jews, and he's going to do that to the church too. He's going to move them to a place where they never wanted to be. He's going to show the Jews that Ephraim has things that he needs, and he's going to show Ephraim that the Jews have things they want in it, that they need. Isn't it amazing what he's going to show? Joseph, Rachel's firstborn, the despised dreamer of Jacob's family, the one who was sold into slavery, has become the prime minister of Egypt, the second most powerful human on the face of the earth. This is Joseph, and like I've said several times, we can talk about Ephraim in this context too. So Ephraim, and who is modern-day Ephraim that we believe? That would be us, the United States. Is the United States not the most powerful force on the face of the earth right now? So God's going to use Ephraim to show Judah some really good things. Yet, as we begin reading in chapter 45, the situation has not really improved for Jacob because of Joseph's rise to power. It really hadn't helped Jacob's family too much, has it, since Joseph has become prime minister. You know, they don't know anything about it. They, you know, really not helping them much. First of all, let's look at Joseph. Yeah, he has power and influence. He has riches, a palace to live in, a beautiful high society wife, two great sons. But look closer for a minute. Who has Joseph become? Joseph started out as the son of Jacob, you know, a Hebrew, promised, you know, part of the promise, had the covenant. But what's he become now? He's not a Hebrew anymore. He's got an Egyptian name. He speaks Egyptian words. He wears Egyptian clothes. He eats Egyptian food. He lives in an Egyptian palace. He serves an Egyptian monarch. He's even taken an Egyptian wife. He's so Egyptian that his brother doesn't even recognize him. Now, does that ring a bell for any of us? Have we become so Egyptian in our walk, in our way of life, that our brother Judah doesn't recognize who we really are? Look at the modern-day Christian faith, how much Egyptian is in it. You've got Christmas, you've got Easter, you've got the quote-unquote Lord's Supper, you've got all of these pagan rituals mixed in with the church's faith. So of course, why would Judah look at us and say, hey, I want to be part of that. That makes me jealous. Let me have what they've got. Of course they're not. They see the idolatry that's in us. You know, I thought it was something interesting to note here that almost, even though Joseph is almost 40 years old, he has not once had a God encounter like Jacob did, or Isaac did, or Abraham did. You know how God came down and spoke to these three men? He would come down and speak to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Joseph hadn't had that, not once in his life. Why do you think that is? Because he'd become assimilated in the Egyptian culture. Now, of course, it wasn't his fault that he got put in Egypt, like it wasn't our fault we got cast out of the land, but he assimilated, he took on all of the Egyptian culture. He cut himself off from his heritage, his birthright, and his destiny. Boy, did that sound like us a few years ago. We had cut ourselves off from the birthright, our heritage, and our destiny. But thank God, God revealed it to us. He has been assimilated. He's responded to this circumstance by blocking out the memory of who he is and of those things at which his purpose and his destiny in life consisted. God has also promised Jacob's grandfather and father that their descendants would have full possession of the land known as Canaan, every place that the feet of Abraham had walked. But the only thing Jacob had presently to show for it was two little small parcels of land. He had the field and the burial plot at Machpelah near Hebron, which Abraham had purchased, and a little tract of land that Jacob himself had purchased near Shechem. And neither of these parcels of land was producing enough food for his family of about 70 to eat, much less feed a nation. Kind of sounds like Israel today, doesn't it? They're having to struggle for every little thing they've got. Even though here we are in America, we're Ephraim, we're Joseph, and we are rich beyond our belief. But poor old Judah's over here struggling for everything he's got. And if you've ever been to the land of Israel, you'll know what I mean. It's not a rich, wonderful, everybody's loaded with money. It's a poor country. Let's talk about Joseph when he reveals himself. There's a point somewhere along this continuum that God extends his mercy to every one of us. He gives us just a moment of when we realize who we truly, truly are. Even as Judah speaks to Joseph about his father's grief, one of these beams of light seemed to just pierce right through Joseph, cuts through him like a knife, and all the way down to his heart. Let's look in verse 1 through 3 in chapter 45. Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried, "Have everyone go out from me." So there was no man with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Judah was talking to Joseph here a minute ago about his poor old father, how that if they lose another son, that it's going to kill him. Joseph finally realizes that he can't do this to his father. He can't bring any more hurt on his father's life. Joseph has finally admitted to himself and acknowledged to his brother who he really is. His Egyptian mask has faded away. He's been awakened to his Hebrew roots. I thought it was interesting that he ordered the room cleared of all his servants. Wasn't that interesting? Why would he do that? Because everybody's going to find out here in just a few verses what's going on. I mean, they go and tell Pharaoh. So why did Joseph have all these people leave the room? Well, I think it's a Ramez level for us. He got rid of the Egyptians in the room. He got rid of the Egyptians in his heart. He got rid of the world in his heart. And then he had his true confession. He finally realized that he was Joseph, not some Egyptian prime minister. He realized that he is Israel. Who all remembers the first time they realized that? I do. I remember when it clicked with me. I am Israel. I was laying in bed one night. I had read some stuff. I was still confused about all this messianic stuff. I didn't know what was going on. You know, my daddy had been a preacher for 20 years. You know, I went to a Christian high school. And now he start talking about doing the Feast of Trumpets and Passover. And I'm like, what is going on with him? He's not eating ham sandwiches anymore. What's up with him? You know, he's lost his mind. And then it clicked with me. If you are of Christ, you are Abraham's seed. And it clicked with me. I'm Israel. I'm Abraham's seed. So everything that was promised to Abraham was promised to me. All the blessings that were given to Abraham and his descendants, they were given to me. Along with that, not only the promises, the responsibilities that went along with those blessings were given to me, which kind of scared me. I don't know about the rest of you. That kind of scared me to death. So I started doing some studying because I thought, if I'm going to be responsible for all this stuff, I better know what I'm talking about. The groaning heard around the world. The power of this self-revelation was overwhelming. It was really an emotional time, wasn't it, when you realized who you were. It really laid on your heart big time. You know, as far as Joseph, when he, you know, realized who he was and revealed himself, he began to weep with such loud sobs that the Egyptians heard, and it was even heard in Pharaoh's palace. Now, that's some serious crying going on, isn't it? But that's what's going to happen in the end times. There's another Ramez level. This whole Torah portion is just loaded with these things. When Ephraim, modern-day Ephraim, as a collective group, realizes who they are, it's going to be heard around the world. That cry and that groan will affect everything on this planet like nothing else ever has. And another interesting thing that it did, it left the brothers totally speechless, didn't it? They didn't know what in the world to think. They were totally unprepared for this. This was their worst nightmare come true. They had cast out this little boy, threw him away, and for all they knew, he was dead and gone. Now they get to Egypt, and uh-oh, he's the second most powerful person on the planet. What are they going to do? I look at this like the brothers are representative of Israel today, modern-day Jews. When they realize who Ephraim, Joseph is, they're going to be scared to death, and rightfully so, they're going to be scared to death. Because what does the modern-day church say about Jews right now? Not very good, do they? They think they're outcasts, they're of no use. They cling to this old religion that's been cast away. I mean, if you want to see some... I mean, who's the father of the Protestant movement? Martin Luther, right? Remember, he went and nailed his thesis on the door. Remember that? If you want to have something to really open your eyes about how great Martin Luther is, go, you know, you talk to some church members and they really think Martin Luther's great. Just go online and type into Google or Yahoo. Go and type Martin Luther and Jews. And start reading some of the things that Martin Luther said that he wanted to do to the Jews. And it will scare you to death. Martin Luther said that Jews should be drug out in the street and killed, their property burnt to the ground. They were of no use. They were bugs. They should be annihilated. And this is what modern-day Christianity is founded on. So, of course, Judah is going to be scared. I would be terrified. So would you. You know, oh my gosh, my brother has been saying this about me for hundreds of years, and we're supposed to be restored as one family. I would be scared too. So we got to cut them some slack sometime. They had no place to go. If they could have run, they would have, but where would they have went? I mean, it's 10 of them versus Egypt. Where are they going to go? The moment was Joseph's. So let's look at verse 4 and see what he says. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come closer to me." And they came closer. And he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." Isn't that something else? Joseph started out talking about how the bad things happened in his life. The brothers took him and sold him into slavery. But then he said, "Don't worry about it. God's the one that used this situation to protect the whole world." And that's what God did when he separated Judah and Ephraim. If God had left the nation of Israel together and not separated, what would have happened to them? They would have been annihilated. But by taking the 10 tribes, casting them out into the nations, what did he do? He protected them. He hid them in plain sight. The best place to hide something is where? In plain sight. And that's exactly what God did. So I think it's ingenious what he did. Joseph has finally acknowledged and reclaimed his Hebrew roots and tapped into something priceless, the covenant. The covenant that his great-grandfather Abraham made with the Holy One of Israel. And like I was talking a minute ago, remember how wonderful it was when we all remembered that, when we remember the covenant that we came upon. Joseph, suddenly alive again to his true identity, his spiritual heritage, and his destiny, proves himself to be a true prophet and friend of God, interpreting the events which have occurred in his lives and the lives of his brothers through the eyes of God himself. The separation is finally over at this point. So what did the prophet say? What declared Joseph to us? Well, the first message is, Joseph's brethren, as well as us today, is that the worst wounds that a brother or anyone can inflict who has a personal covenant with the created universe are no basis to sulk or take up offense or adopt a self-righteous attitude. I'm right, good, he's bad, he's wrong. You know, that's really hard sometimes, isn't it? It's really easy for us to hold a grudge against people, isn't it? I mean, I can hold a grudge. Anybody else can hold a grudge in here? A lot of us can. That's one of my weaknesses. I can admit it. I can hold a grudge. But when we think about it, when the tribulation hits and the church is, you know, realizes what's going on, do you ever think about this? Some of our most vocal critics may become some of the most great leaders in the tribulation. Do you think about that for a minute? That'd be kind of scary, wouldn't it? Some of those people. I remember when we first got into the Messianic movement, there was a certain person in the county that stood up and said some terrible things, some ridiculous things about us, that we were sacrificing cats and that we were going to, how they put it, going to Jerusalem to eat grapes. I mean, they were saying terrible things, ridiculous things about us. And it would be easy to hold a grudge against that person, wouldn't it? Real easy. But now what happens if we get into tribulation and God decides to make this person one of the 144,000? It could very easily happen. They're just as worthy as we are when they realize who they are. So once again, we got to fight that arrogance. We can't hold a grudge against church or anyone else for that. He's calling forth a holy supernatural nation, and we need everyone we can get. Let's look at verse 6 through 11 right quick in chapter 45. For the famine has been in these lands for 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by great deliverance. Now therefore it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his household and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry up and go to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me and do not delay. You shall live in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children, and your flocks and your herds and all that you have. There I will also provide for you, for there are still 5 years of famine to come. You and your household and all that you have would be impoverished. This is going to happen again. When the church realizes who they are, when Judah realizes who they are, denominations, doctrines, churches, synagogues are going to crumble, and they're going to finally realize who they are, and we have to be there for them. When Judah, the Jews of today, realize who they are and they come to us, we've got a perspective on end-time prophecy that Judah doesn't have right now. You know, we've got the Messiah. We've got the New Testament that they've ignored. Now, vice versa, the church has got a lot to learn from Judah, too, because they've taken the Old Testament and pretty much thrown it out. So when we get together, we're going to be one powerful nation. So we've got to get through these grudges and these other things and become a family again. I know this is scattered tonight, y'all, but this is such a huge, huge, huge Torah portion. I don't know which way to go with it. We're going to jump down here now into starting into verse 16 here in just a minute. But after all this, Joseph has broken down into uncontrollable sobs. He's given up his advantage. If, you know, just a few seconds ago, Joseph had the advantage. He had the 11 brothers just where he wanted them. He could have had them taken all out, but all of a sudden his heart melts, and he's all about restoration, which is a great way to be. Let's move on to Pharaoh. I'm trying to skim through a lot of this because I still have a lot to go through. Let's talk about Pharaoh and his invitation. It's all great that Pharaoh issued this invitation to Joseph and his family, but of course we have to remember this is Egypt. This isn't the promised land that they're coming to. They're coming to a very, very pagan land. If you've ever done any study on ancient Egypt, they had gods on top of gods on top of gods and pagan rituals that were unbelievable. So we've got Jacob's family coming from relatively protected in their faith here in Canaan down to, you know, Egypt. It's kind of like if you go from here, Marion, and you go to New Orleans during Mardi Gras is a good way to put it. Who all's been to New Orleans before? That's a wild city, even if it's not Mardi Gras, but that's the best kind of example I can give you. It's wild. So here's a good question. What is Jacob going to say about all this? I mean, is Jacob going to want to leave his home and come live in such a pagan city? Because Jacob's older now, and he realizes what paganism and idolatry can do to him. So what's he going to do? Is he going to do it? So God has those little details covered. Pharaoh hears that Joseph's brothers have come from Canaan in search of food and issues this generous, highly persuasive invitation for them to come to Egypt. Here's basically what he said. This is what you must do. Load up your beasts and go directly to Canaan. Bring your father and your families and come to me. I will give you the good land and you will eat the fat of the land. Now, let's jump down to verse 17 because this one struck me. And I've been studying Torah for a long time, and for some reason this just has always skipped by me. I'd never saw this till today. Verse 17, then Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, do this, load your beasts and go into the land of Canaan. take your father and your households and come to me, and I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you'll eat of the fat of the land. In verse 19 and 20 is where it really struck me. Now you are ordered, do this, take wagons from the land of Egypt for your little ones and for your wives, and bring your father and come. Do not concern yourself with goods, for the beast, for the best of all of the lands of Egypt is yours. Now, that just struck me today. And let me turn here. Now, you are ordered, do this, take wagons from the land of Egypt for your little ones and for your wives, and bring your father and come. And then in verse 20, do not concern yourselves with your goods, for the best of all of the land of Egypt is yours. Now, isn't that interesting that he told him, don't worry about your stuff. All your stuff you've got in Canaan, just leave it there. Get, you know, just pack up and come with me. Leave all your stuff there and come down here to Egypt. Does that make any sense whatsoever? Now, let's think about it for a minute. We're in a worldwide famine right here. Even though Egypt's got food, there's still 5 more years of a severe famine coming. But Pharaoh's telling these guys to go home, get their dad, get their kid, get their wives. Don't bring any of your stuff. Don't bring anything with you. Just come on down to Egypt. Does that kind of strike anybody as strange? It did me today. Basically, what Pharaoh is wanting is Israel, Jacob, and all his family to leave their Hebrew stuff behind. He's not talking about their physical stuff. He's talking about leave their heritage behind. He knows he's not a dummy. I mean, he didn't become Pharaoh by being a dummy. You know, he didn't keep that position by being stupid. He knows that when these people come down here, he's read the stories about Jacob and his family. This is not some unknown family. This is, you know, the descendants of Abraham. You know, this was a big family. Pharaoh wants them to forget their Hebrew roots. Kind of sounds like us, don't it? The world wants us to forget our Hebrew roots. Pharaoh wanted Israel to be Egyptian, not Hebraic. He's not willing to accept the Hebrews as they are. They got to leave their stuff behind. What he is insisting is that Israel assimilate and become like him. Well, basically, I mean, you know, Pharaoh heard Joseph when he revealed himself to his brothers, right? He heard him cry. He heard him yell and weep and mourn. Well, now he knows that Joseph realizes he's not an Egyptian. He's a Hebrew. So does that mean now that Joseph is going to start looking out for the Hebrews and not the Egyptians like he has for the past few years? Or is his loyalty going to be with his family? So Pharaoh knows that Joseph is very popular and he's very good at his job, so he doesn't want to see Joseph go away. He wants to get Joseph back like he was before the revelation. So the best way he can do that is get his family to assimilate. So if all the family does all this Egyptian stuff, there's a good chance that Joseph will do all this Egyptian stuff. You see where I'm going with this? How many of you have suffered through that this week? The rest of the family's doing Christmas. They'll just come on over and have Christmas dinner with us. Just call it a dinner. Or like I've been told before, just call it a friendship dinner. It'll be okay. Don't you like that one, a friendship dinner? Or like an email that I had the pleasure, and I put that word in quotes, of reading. There is a group, a Torah observant, and I use that word very loosely, messianic group, that sent out the, quote, Christmas greetings to some of their members. Except they didn't call it Christmas. What was it they called it? Messiahmas is what they called it. They didn't call it Christmas. They called it Messiahmas. Does that not just turn your stomach? I'm afraid my daddy's going to break out here if I don't move on here, so I better be careful. Let's take this whole idea of the Pharaoh and take it into the modern day. Basically, Pharaoh's wagons are coming for us. You know, they're coming for our children, they're coming for our marriage, they're coming for our hearts, they're coming for our minds and our very own souls. What they're basically is saying is leave all that Hebrew covenant with God stuff behind. Drop all that, be done with it. Now, how many of you would be welcome back into the church if you dropped all this Hebrew stuff right now? Every one of us would be. If we stood up and said, I was wrong, all this Hebrew stuff, I made a mistake, I'll do Sunday worship, I'll do Christmas, I'll do Easter, they'd take you back in, wouldn't they? They'd watch you for a while, but they'd take you back in. So when all these things happen, when Egypt comes for you, what are you going to do? Are you going to be able to remain Joseph, or are you going to become Egyptian? Look at yourself right now. Look closely. Look at the way you talk. Look at what you eat. Look at how you study. Look what's important in your life. What's more important to you? Is it more important to study your Torah, or is it more important to go out and have fun? Would you rather go watch a movie, or would you rather study Torah? What's more important? That's where this whole teaching comes in, is are you going to be assimilated into Egypt? What efforts have you made since the last Sabbath to obtain counsel from God as to how to live your life? What's your most frequent area of sin? What's the most frequent topic of conversation when you talk to other people? What do you talk about most? Do you talk about the ball game, what was on TV last week, or do you talk about Torah? You know, asking yourself these questions and learning from these questions will help you not be assimilated, will help you stay out of Egypt, and you'll remain Joseph. You won't be Egypt anymore. I want to cover one more thing before we close, because I know it's getting late. Let's look to verse 21. 21 and 22 in Genesis 45. Then the sons of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them wagons according to the command of Pharaoh, and gave them provisions for the journey. To each of them he gave changes of garments, but to Benjamin he gave 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of garments. Now you guys know how much, if you've ever heard me teach, you know I like to take Hebrew words and break them down and learn things from them. I love gematria, I love word pictures. So that word garments for some reason just clicked up to me. So I looked up the word garments, and it was really, really interesting. If I can get it to pull up here. My computer's being stubborn tonight. Okay, the word garments is simla, and it means a wrapper, a mantle, a covering, a garment, garments, clothes. But it's not the root word. So we got to go all the way to the root word. So the root word is the Hebrew word. It's the Strong's word, excuse me, H5566. It's semel, S-E-M-E-L is how we transliterate it. It's got a somic, a mem, and a lamed in it. And the root word was amazing what it meant. Now remember, Joseph gave his brothers these changes of garments, right? So the root word of garments is, are you ready for it? Idol. It means an image, a statue, an idol. So in other words, Joseph gave his brothers an idol. So Joseph hadn't completely got Egypt out of his system yet. And then I did a word picture of the word semel, the root word. And like I said, it had a somic, a mem, and a lamed in it. And what I got from it means the chaos will twist the leader. So the chaos of idolatry twisted the leader, Joseph, didn't it? So we have to be very careful that we not get assimilated in this day and time. It's very easy for us to do that. I know, folks, this has been scattered. I know you're used to a much, much better, higher level teaching than what I can give you. But if you've ever had the opportunity to sit up here and teach the Torah, it is not easy. I think everybody should try to do it one time. If you can't get up here in front of anybody, just try to put together a study to do this. We've been talking here for about an hour. Anyone want to guess how many hours I spent just putting this together? About 10 hours I did just for this 1 hour is what it takes to put together something like this. So I know it's scattered, and I hope you forgive me. Hopefully next week Gary will be back, and he'll be able to fix any damage that I did and add more to it. So with that, we'll just close in prayer. Heavenly Father God, thank you for this day, Lord, and thank you for all you've given us, Lord, and thank you for helping us through this recent time, Lord. We know that it's hard on us that don't celebrate the holiday that just passed, Lord, and it gets frustrating on us towards the end of it, and the next couple of weeks are going to be tough on us, Lord, and I just ask that you give all of us the grace and mercy when we get asked the questions that we don't want to hear, Lord, that we have the ability to speak to these people that don't understand the truth, that we speak to them, Lord, in a way that honors you, yet isn't cruel or mean or arrogant to them, Lord. Just help us the rest of this week, Lord. Help us with the Torah portion as we go throughout our week, Lord. And bring it to life for us, Lord, and help us as we go through our daily walk, Lord. For it's in your precious name we pray. Amen.